Billy Krutzinger is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Krutzinger to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Larry Douglas, criminal defense attorney Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Joseph Clark, and special guest James Riddick, an attorney specializing in the defense of death row prisoners appealing their convictions. The Execution Watch for Billy Krutzinger begins. Good evening and welcome to Execution Watch on this Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. We're here to bring you coverage of the scheduled execution of Billy Jack Krutzinger. Now, whether you're listening to our live coverage on one of our FM stations, such as 90.1 FM Houston, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, we want to thank you for joining us. I'm your host for this evening, Larry Douglas. If you're tuning in for Arab Voices, which is usually heard this every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back with us next week when they resume their regular schedule. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about death penalty and executions in Texas, feel free to join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. And join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight, we're here to witness the state of Texas' planned execution of Billy Jack Krutzinger. So we hear that there are no Supreme Court interventions right now, so it looks as though the execution very well might proceed. Before we begin, as we're planning, we've got Joseph Clark, who is in Huntsville. Joseph, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Just tell us what's going on in Huntsville right now.
Well, right now we got about 10 protesters lined up out here in protest of Krutzinger's execution. And supposedly the Supreme Court just denied his last appeal. The witnesses haven't crossed the road yet. The chimes are going off. The bells are going off as they usually do every 6 o'clock at execution.
Okay, explain to us about the significance of the chimes of the bells going off, Joseph.
Well, I've been out here for almost 2 years now, and every time the bells go off, that usually means that the execution is going to take place. And they usually go off around 6 o'clock. And they're coming from the warden's house across the street from the unit.
Okay, and the bells.
The witnesses are crossing the road right now.
Now, explain to our listeners what the significance is, Joseph, of the witnesses crossing the road.
Once the witnesses cross the road, that means that the execution is going to take place. So that means that the prisoner is already in the chamber and that they're proceeding with the execution.
Now, when the witnesses cross the road, where are they crossing from, where are they crossing to, and what exactly is that road?
The witnesses are in the unit building, like the administration building, and they're there waiting to see if the Supreme Court is going to rule or not. And once the Supreme Court makes the ruling to proceed, they cross the road to the main unit to where the death chamber is at, and that's when everything proceeds.
And how many witnesses are there again, Joseph?
As I know, they got media witnesses, and they also have three witnesses for Billy himself, Minsky, Linda, and Danny.
Okay, and what is their relationship to Krutzinger?
Linda and Danny are just friends, and they offer moral support for him. And Minsky is a spiritual advisor. And we were all at the hospitality house before all this took place. And we got to speak to him on the phone. And he was very uplifting, saying that his heart's in the right place if all this proceeds.
You're saying that Kretzinger is very uplifting?
Yes, he was very uplifting. He was in good spirits. He was hoping for a stay, but he said if it didn't go through, that he knows where he's going because his heart's in the right place.
So you had an opportunity to speak to him or to hear him speak? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I got an opportunity to speak to him for a couple minutes.
This is just you and him face-to-face directly?
No, it was over the phone.
Okay. So you spoke to him over the phone. How many people do you know were allowed to speak to him, if you know?
When I was there, he called the hospitality house, and we kind of passed the phone around amongst four people, and we just spoke to him for a couple hours.
So he was where when he made this phone call, if you know?
Yes, he was.
No, where was he? Was he in the chamber then?
No, I think he was in the holdover room.
Okay. And about what time was this, Joseph?
This was around 2 or 3 o'clock.
So you guys have been there for a while?
Yes, we've been at the hospitality house since about 11 o'clock.
And how many of you guys were there at the hospitality house?
It was about four of us together, not including the TDC chaplain.
Okay, the TDC chaplain was there in the hospitality house with you guys, visiting with you?
Yes, they were.
Okay. Now, I understand that you might have a guest there, someone, a visitor from across the pond?
Yes, we have a lady from England.
Did you want to introduce her, and did you want to have any comments? Do you know?
Sure. I hear you.
Who is this?
Hello? Yes. Who am I speaking to? Can you introduce yourself to our audience? Hello?
It's Gemma.
Gemma?
Yeah.
Okay. And can you...
Oh, yeah.
Now you're speaking to our audience here at KPFT's Execution Watch, and I understand that you are there for what reason now?
We're here supporting and protesting outside.
Okay. Now, and can you tell us where you are from?
Where I'm from?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm from the UK.
Okay. And what brings you to Texas, particularly to Huntsville?
Well, I'm married to a guy on death row. I'm married to Joe Luna.
Okay. So Mr. Luna is there in death row?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Okay, and you guys are married?
Yes, we are, yeah.
So how is he doing? I guess we hear the protesters in the back, correct?
Yeah, it's hard to hear you, yeah.
Okay. Are there any words of comfort, any words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our audience regarding the death penalty as it applies in Texas?
We just have to keep fighting, really, and just keep hoping that it ends, and it ends soon. We just have to keep fighting it.
What's the attitude regarding our death penalty here in Texas? What is that attitude back where you're from?
Well, in the UK, we don't obviously agree with it because we don't have it anymore. So my kind of thinking about it is very different to what it is over here. I mean, obviously, you have the people that don't agree with it, but you have people that do agree with it. And obviously, my feeling is it's not anybody's right to choose who lives and who dies. So that's my view. I know, obviously, I can only give my view, but predominantly in the UK, that's how we feel about it. So.
Okay, so that is your view, and you believe that your view is a predominant view in the United Kingdom.
I'm sorry.
Hello?
So, yeah, say it again.
I said your view is the predominant view you believe in the United Kingdom?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Can you turn it back over to Joseph?
Yes,
and
hold on.
Thank you for your help, for your comments.
Hello?
Yes, Joseph?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that there were how many protesters now?
We have about 12 out here now.
Okay. Now, about 12 protesters against the death penalty.
Yes, sir.
Are there any counter-protesters at all?
Well, that's on the other side of the street, and we really can't see them. So if there is anybody out there, I couldn't tell.
So when you say on the other side of the street, are you saying that you guys can't even get a view of each other?
No, sir, we can't get a view of each other. They usually keep us separated.
And so you can't tell whether there are any counter-protesters or how many there are, if there are even any?
No, sir.
Okay, okay. And who's that on the bullhorn that we heard a minute ago?
That's Ms. Gloria Rubeck.
So Gloria's out there doing her thing and protesting.
Yes, sir, as usual.
Okay, okay. Any additional comments for us, Joseph, before we let you go for now? And I'm sure we'll check back with you later.
I mean, I don't have anything else to say. It's a really tragic event. I hate to do this job, but somebody has to do it.
Somebody has to do it, and we'd like to keep our public informed, so we do want to thank you for your information. Okay, thanks a lot, Joseph. We'll be checking back with you later. Okay, that was the update from Huntsville. We are in the studio now with my co-host, Mike Gillespie, and we've got a real death penalty expert here tonight, James Riddick. And we're just going to talk just for a few minutes to bring the public up to date on the kinds of things that we believe our audience needs to know about this case. We're not trying to duplicate what you might find out by reading the paper or listening to another show. We like to give you our unique perspective of some of the issues that you might not hear other places. So we're going to begin, though, with Mike just giving us a brief description, a brief outline of the underlying facts of the case that we're discussing here. We're not going to go into a lot of detail, but we'll just give you the brief outline that so that we'll know what we're talking about Mr. Billy Jack Crutzinger.
What we have in this case is a man, Billy Jack Crutzinger, who is working for two ladies, a mother and a daughter, 84 and 71, doing repair work. Something happened, he got upset, and he stabbed them 17 times and 19 times, stole the credit card, stole the car, and left. The bodies weren't found for 2 days, but when the bodies were found, the police put out a notice on the credit card and saw it was being used in Galveston. So they went to Galveston and found him. They found him, and he told them who he was, and they talked to him. Now, this case got a lot of publicity because a horrible crime was committed on a mother and a daughter, 84 and 71. They were brutally stabbed. They were horribly murdered. It was a public outcry in a small town. The question that we always have on this show is that should the death penalty be imposed uniformly on equal to everybody or depend upon where the crime is committed? There's no question to me that this crime in Harris County would not be a death penalty case. We had yesterday two cases, one in which a man ran over and killed a homeless man and a six-year-old boy, and he got prison. And we had another man yesterday tried to do two contract murders, and he got prison. Some counties do not look at things as serious as other counties do.
Okay, Michael, let me just interrupt you just for a minute here, because you're contrasting counties. So we're talking about Harris County, Houston.
That's correct.
And this occurred in Tarrant County.
That's correct.
Fort Worth.
But more important, I'm talking about counties. The location makes the death penalty case, sometimes not the crime. And it's not important, Harris County or whatever county was in. It's what do the people in that county feel. Now, the law does have the judgment of the people who live there. But what we have over here is a more interesting case.
But what I was bringing up is that this was a Fort Worth,
that's right,
Tarrant
Fort
County
Tarrant
case.
Case,
so you're saying that in Fort Worth, Tarrant County, the cases would be looked at differently than in Houston, Harris County.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Now, and isn't that a big change, Mike? Because Harris County still is actually the death penalty capital of Texas.
Money question.
And it used to be if the odds were stacked against you, not for you, in Harris County when it came to capital punishment.
I don't know. I saw a man on bond for capital murder just commit another murder. I don't understand how Harris County can be the leader in capital murder when capital murder people make bond. I know a policeman at the courthouse who pointed out to me, a man walking past him, he says, that man shot me 11 times last month, and he's out on bond.
Okay, so we're bringing up, I guess, another subject. It's not just Harris County as compared to Tarrant County, but Harris County today as compared to Harris County even the last couple of years.
And all
some changes are going on in Harris County even.
And all that's true. My concern right now is not how horrible the crime was, not the public reaction to the crime, but I don't think anybody really looked at this man and who he was and what he was going through. Because what we have is somebody who everybody should have seen, he's about to explode. Let's go over some of his facts. He did have a bad criminal background. He had one misdemeanor, one injury to a child. I think he did a year on that. That's not a bad criminal background. But what you have is a man who went through three marriages. You have a man who lost a newborn daughter, a son who drowned, and a teenage son with lymphomania. His brother died from an illness, and his father was hit by a car, and his sister was killed in a car crash that he was driving. How much tragedy can one person put up with? He was driving a car that his sister got killed in. His father died in a car accident. His daughter died. His son died from drowning. Where was anybody to help this man? He had an alcohol problem. He lost his jobs. His last wife left him. He was despondent. He was down on his luck. Nobody would help him. He went to these people to get work, to get money to live. They didn't have enough money to give him, and so he killed them. You can't excuse the crime. It's a horrible crime. But the issue right now is, does he deserve to die or not? We're not talking about a person with a criminal history of violence. The main question we have on death penalty cases is a chance that he would have to commit violent acts in the future. I don't know if he would commit violent acts in the future. Most of these cases, we see facts of what happened in jail, what happened since he was arrested, things he did that shows he's still violent. There's nothing on this man. What you have is a man whose crime was so repulsive to society that they choose to execute him without looking at the man himself.
Okay, so we've got Mr. Krutzinger, who was reportedly going to do some work for two elderly ladies, a mother and a daughter, one 71, the other late 80s.
84.
Okay, so, and he stabbed them and stole their car and credit cards and used them.
Right.
Okay, and so that made him death eligible. That is, two murders in the same episode.
And the two people we talked about today in Harris County, they were both capital eligible too, I believe.
Right. So what we're talking about now is the prosecutor's discretion. They can decide whether to seek the death penalty or not.
And many times that decision is based on the community, and if a community is a more rural community with more traditional values, they might be more inclined to do a death penalty than a big city like Houston. But we're talking about Fort Worth, Dallas. That's a major city, too.
And we're lucky.
Well, actually, the truth is that the major counties are the ones that most frequently seek the death penalties, and that is because they have the resources to do it. The death penalty, because of the cost of litigating it up through federal habeas and on to the Supreme Court, as happened in this case, is too much for small county budgets to bear. It's only the wealthy counties that traditionally have pursued death penalties in substantial numbers. So you're looking at Fort Worth, Tarrant County, Dallas County, Bexar County, and Harris County primarily. And that's starting to change too, because now these counties, as has Harris County, are going Democratic. So we may see far less use of discretion to pursue death penalties across the state in the major counties. I think that's going to make a big difference.
Well, but, the thing about certain counties have more death penalty cases, well, my position on that is that when you live in a small county in Texas, if you don't fit in, they run you out of town, and they go to the big cities. People from country small towns who are not like there go to the big cities where they're not known. We have a lot of these cases in here because we get all the people from small towns who are not wanted there. So I don't think it's always small towns. I think big cities attract people like that. And I think that's why we have so much.
And you've been listening to me, Larry Douglas, and Mike Gillespie. There's another voice you heard just a minute ago that you might not recognize. And we are privileged tonight. You are privileged to have James Riddick with us. Okay, now, Mike and I we're guys in the trenches, whereas James Riddick is a certified death penalty appellate lawyer. He
handles, I do what's called post-conviction appeals, commonly known as habeas corpus.
So tell us a little bit about that as compared to what Mike and I do in terms of what you guys do. Because in death penalty cases, that's where the real action is in terms of whether a person is going to be executed or not.
Well, as in all cases, the main event is the trial court.
Right.
And that is where the die is cast, except in fairly rare cases. Then you have an appellate process, which is based on the record. That is, the appellate attorneys just look at what's down there on the paper, what the court reporter has transcribed, and they look for errors made by the attorneys, made by the judges. But it's all done on the record. Then you get to go to post-conviction proceedings, state habeas followed by federal habeas, and there you can start investigating again. That's the important difference. And so in my cases, where I make a difference is if I have good investigation, if I'm able to develop claims that weren't brought before and issues that weren't looked at before. And in the Krutziner case, if you look at the trial record, you actually see that the trial attorneys did what I consider to be a decent, if not a very good job. They attempted to get the professional help that they needed. They had a strategy of contesting his arrest and confession. They were saddled with the fact that he had confessed not only to the officer and to a nurse. So the guilt-innocent phase was going to be a uphill slide. But they did their what any attorney would. They tried to challenge those confessions. And then they also got the professional assistance that they thought was necessary to litigate the case at the punishment phase. And the question with Mr. Krutziner really isn't so much did he get bad representation, but is he the type of person that merits the death penalty? And if you look at his background, as Mike laid out, he had a terrible one. This is what you see in case after case. And underneath it all is a life of extreme poverty. And with that, there was also borderline intelligence. He was down and out. He was under pressure and anxieties that people in these circumstances routinely face, but our society does not, as yet, understand the severe consequences that they can have for mental health, for well-being, for your ability to control your judgment and make good decisions. They all came crashing down on Mr. Krutziner after he thought he had some sort of gainful employment, after he was out of his home, lost out of another marriage, and then found himself destitute again. And also complicated by his substance abuse. So that constellation of facts led to this murder. It wasn't, and it's just false to say that he was an extraordinarily evil person. That's just not reflected by his record. He was not a sociopath. He did not have a history of conduct disorder before he was 15. His brush-ins with the law, although there were several, they weren't violent crimes that he got convicted for. Yet he finds himself on death row after he, I think it's safe to say, essentially lost his mind and ended up killing two people.
So you're saying counsel could have done a better job on the future dangers in this part of the case?
I don't know if that's the case. Whether they could have done a future job on future dangerousness. That's always almost an impossible hill to climb, even though we do have superb work done by a Texas professor at Sam up in Huntsville, who has shown that death penalty defendants on the row are less inclined to be future dangers than the general population is. And they're in isolation. And there's no reason, and he has no history in prison after 17 years now, of committing violent acts. He wasn't a future dangerous to society.
You've read more of these cases than I have, but in the cases that I've read, I've never seen one with less facts of future dangerous than him. There's nothing about him to show future dangerousness. And realistically, isn't that the real moral justification for execution? Future dangerousness to save other lives? Not punishment.
Well, if that was the moral justification for the death penalty, there would be no death penalty, because keeping someone in segregation is going to reduce their violent acts towards others. They're not going to be a threat to society. They're not even in society.
But
the idea that they're... So they have to expand the difference of future dangerousness to include any sort of criminal activity. Are you going to spit on the guard, for example? That comes up. But that is not a future danger to society in any meaningful sense of the word. The real question is, at the death penalty phase, really, is not so much future dangerousness. That's a throwaway prong that they use. It's whether there is what we call mediating factors, mediating evidence, or mitigating evidence is the proper term, that militates, as we say, or against the death penalty.
What about the fact that when the police confronted him, he basically didn't try to hide it and cover it up? Shouldn't that be some mitigation to his future dangerousness, that he didn't try to deny it or cover it up or hide it? He confessed and he cooperated.
Apparently his confession was rather remorseful, that he broke down.
Again, so...
And said, I've done something terrible.
Doesn't that count?
I really think it should count. This wasn't someone that was... trying to hide, that was trying to skate, that had plans to commit, you know, more violent acts. He was someone that was absolutely distraught, the record seems to indicate, about what he had done. And because of that, because of his own reflection on what he had done, he tearfully... confessed.
What if the media report on his case wasn't the focus of the victims, but the focus on him and what he went through and what caused him to do these acts? Do you think that might have made a difference in the case? Did the DA's office is looking for the death penalty?
If the media reports
were not about a murdered mother and daughter, but about this poor man who lost his mind and ended up killing a mother and a daughter.
But the decision would be made in the court, though. So all of that would come in court.
Yeah, but the media painted this as a murder, a horrible, evil man who murdered these people. And I'm saying, if the media would have reported as a troubled man who committed a horrible crime, might that have made a difference in the DA's handling of the case?
The DA seeking the death penalty.
The DA seeking the death penalty. Because it's not that much of a capital murder case compared to the ones we've seen. He killed two people, but compared to the other ones we've had, it was a one-time occurrence. He showed remorse. He had emotional problems. These are the reasons why he should have been able to present this in court. Now, there was a reason you mentioned to me why the lawyer didn't use this in court, didn't use a psychologist in court.
Well, he did use a psychologist, and they did use professional help. I'm not faulting the lawyers for their performance at trial. I do believe that there was a misdiagnosis of an antisocial personality disorder, just given my review of the records, because he did not have a history before he was 15 of antisocial behavior or... and there was no diagnosis of a conduct disorder before the age of 15. And that's necessary. That's just black letter psychology in order to diagnose with someone with antisocial personality disorder. But once a expert comes up with that diagnosis, pretty much blown that expert. They can't be used at trial because that's because if they go to trial, their reports are going to have to be published to the other side, produced to the other side. And that's what the DA is going to go straight for. So if there was an error in the case that I think that was serious, it was that misdiagnosis. And it could have made a difference in this situation.
And what does it mean to have an antisocial personality? I mean, does that mean you get the death penalty? I mean, antisocial personality, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, I know technically what it means, but that's not a grounds to execute somebody.
Well, in the Texas system, you have your guilt-innocence phase, and then you have your punishment phase. And at the punishment phase, the jury is asked two questions. Is there sufficient mitigating evidence to make this a crime that's not worthy of the death penalty? And the second question is the defendant going to be a future danger to society? And if the jury has to answer both those questions, yes. The future dangerous questions, he answers yes. The mitigating evidence, they say no. If that's the combination of answers, then the death penalty is automatically imposed
by
the court.
But where does the antisocial behavior fit into this?
Well, that's because the jury has to make a decision about mitigating evidence. And if someone has an antisocial personality disorder, that means they have limited to no fellow feelings. They're concerned just for themselves and their own gain. They will use other people. They have a history of doing so, and it's a fixed aspect of their personality.
And I just have to break in just for a moment just to let everybody know that you are now listening to Execution Watch on 90.1 KTF, KPFT Radio. I flubbed that a little bit. So, James, no matter where people's feelings are on the death penalty, the pro or con, I hear a lot of people say, well, it just takes so long from the time the death penalty is imposed until there is a finality, that it just, you know, we're talking 17 years here, and the public has sometimes some difficulty understanding the complexity of the post-conviction process, okay? So if you could just give us a thumbnail sketch of how that goes about, you know, what the procedures are in getting you from the jury imposing the death penalty to the direct appeal, the automatic appeal. Could you just describe that process for us, just for our viewers, listeners?
Yes, right after the trial, it usually takes couple months at least for the record to even be prepared. After that, the attorneys have to read the record and file their briefs. That can take up to a year for those to be completed, what with extensions often necessary given that people have additional cases and other work. And then the court makes a decision. They too have a docket that is, in Texas, extraordinarily large. Because all death penalty cases go to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is handling thousands of other appeals as well.
So that's the direct appeal.
That's the direct appeal. So the direct appeal may not be finished for a couple years. Usually, maybe 1-2 years. 1 year would be very swift. A couple years would be average. Some go on even longer than that. Then you go into state habeas, and that is where a new attorney is assigned, generally, and the case is, to a limited extent, reopened. The state habeas attorney can get an investigator, and they can start looking at other witnesses. They can see if the prosecution withheld evidence. They can go get that, finally go get the entire file. They can start interviewing the defense counsel to see why they made their decisions.
So this
and
is
that
the
all
state
takes
collateral kind of.
This is called collateral review.
Okay.
And it takes, as you can imagine, time. It takes a year to prepare that state habeas petition.
Okay, now, just for our listeners now, what's the difference between the collateral state habeas as compared to the direct appeal?
The direct appeal is based entirely on the record being the transcripts of trial. You don't get to go and say, well, I found this new witness. I found another alibi, a witness. Or I discovered that the prosecution didn't turn over this document that would have helped the defense at trial. You can't do that on direct appeal. You're stuck with what we call the record. And the record is the trial transcripts and the pleadings that were filed with the clerk's office.
Okay.
At state habeas, you can get yourself an investigator. You can apply for expert assistance, such as a psychologist, or in cases that I've had, get yourself a pathologist or an entomologist. You have to meet standards. It's not as if they're throwing them at you. But then you can start raising new issues. That's what state habeas allows you to do.
And talk about the issue in this case about funding, because I didn't now understand what they were getting to. That's the funding the appellate court denied him to do that work. Is that correct?
What happened in the federal system, and this is what we're talking about.
Right.
This is the latest appeal that Mr. Kreutzinger tried to get a stay of execution based upon. His attorneys had asked for funding in the federal system, and they were denied. They were asking for funding for psychological expert, and they were denied that funding because the court looked at what happened at the trial below, and looked what happened during state habeas, and said these issues have already been adequately investigated. That was his conclusion. And not only that, his conclusion was that the use of the experts had been effective, so you're not going to be able to demonstrate to me that you are going to be able to develop a viable claim in the federal proceedings. So he denied that funding. And Mr. Kreutzinger's very able attorney, Lydia Brandt, realized that there was a mechanism to perhaps reopen the closed judgment of the district court by using what's called a Rule 60B procedure. And she did so by challenging that denial of funding. She said that is what made the habeas process in the federal system unfair, and we need now to go back and revisit this issue. And her argument had some legs to it because in the interim, between the time when his federal petition was denied and her 60B action, the Supreme Court had passed a case, Yeasta versus Davis, that was favorable to her position, that said that the standards for getting funding were not as high as the ones that were used by when her funding decision was initially denied. But I don't believe that, I'm sure we've had word by now that litigation has come to the end and she didn't prevail.
But that funding issue is, if I understand what you're saying, is on reopening the issue of the lawyer being competent.
Well, that was one of the big problems that Ms. Brandt had. It was finding a constitutional claim that she could bring. She had to, really what was left to her was an ineffectiveness of counsel claim. She had to say that trial counsel was ineffective, and then state habeas, too, was not effective in challenging the trial counsel's performance.
It just seems to be what you said earlier about his mental condition, the troubles in his life, and what happened to him. Those are the issues that should have been on the federal writ of habeas corpus, and they were not investigated. Only, to get this correct, the lawyer was invested. They wanted to disqualify. They wanted to say inadequacy of a lawyer because he didn't investigate those issues.
Well, that's what the federal litigation was about. She needed not only to show that the denial of funds was incorrect, but that it prevented her from developing a viable claim, a viable constitutional claim.
And we're not
claim.
Talking about a viable claim on the verdict. We're talking about a viable claim on the verdict. Nobody is questioning whether it should have been a death penalty case to begin with, because that's not questionable. Once the DA decides to make it a capital case, that's off the table for the appellate courts to change? Because we talked about his future dangers, his lack of past history, his mental illness. That seems to be a question of why was this a capital case?
Right. In Texas, capital cases fall under certain categories. We don't... In some states, you have a murder, but it has to be... There have to be aggravating factors for it to be a capital case. And they go through those aggravating factors. It has to be particular heinous. That's often one. And it showed some, callous disregard for life. There's a list of aggravating factors in other states. In Texas, that's not how it's done. You have a murder, and you have to have a murder in the course of a felony, such as robbery or sexual assault. Or you have to have murder, and then there have to be other circumstances. Like, as we mentioned, two people were killed, or someone under 10 years old was killed, and that makes it a capital case. And if that's satisfied, and there's generally no question about those categories being satisfied, then it cannot be challenged. It just fits under state law as the definition of a capital case.
So that can't be appealed. That's the decision by the prosecutor, and that's it.
That is
the only person.
That is correct. I mean, you could appeal it and say, "Well, look, only one guy was killed, and you charged me. The other guy lived." Yeah. but that's not going to happen.
The case yesterday where the guy killed two people, including a six-year-old boy, the prosecutor decided not to make that a capital. That can't be reversed either. That's the decision the prosecutors
make.
I'm not
certain about the facts of the case. It may be that the prosecutor thought that it was both were died, and it wasn't a murder. It was a manslaughter issue.
Okay.
I don't know about that case. You'll have to fill me in on that one.
Okay. And as our readers our listeners can understand, this is a complicated process, and not a complicated process. This is a series of complicated processes. So, James, you were saying you've got the direct appeal.
That's correct.
On the state side.
That's correct.
Then you've got the state collateral, the habeas. And the next step is?
Federal habeas.
Federal habeas.
That's correct.
Okay, that's a collateral procedure.
That is what we call a collateral procedure, as just to distinguish it from direct appeal.
Okay.
There's really nothing more fancy about that. It's just not the direct appeal. It's you get to challenge using, and again, you get to go outside the record.
And then after the federal habeas, then?
Clemency.
Okay, that's another step.
It is another possibility for you to get relief, and that is very rarely awarded. It happened recently, though, in Thomas Whitaker's case.
Okay, but even after the federal habeas, that there can be more than one step. You can appeal the habeas, and on the federal side, from the if you get a certificate of appealability to the Supreme Court, the steps of federal habeas, what are they? What can they possibly be?
Well, you file a petition. It's like a lawsuit in the district court,
okay,
in the federal district court. Then you litigate that, just much like a civil suit.
Okay.
You don't have a jury, but you're going right before the judge. He may grant you an evidentiary hearing if you meet very strict standards. If you lose, or if you win, the case is appealed, just like civil cases are often appealed, to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Okay. So you can see there are many steps that a person who is convicted and sentenced to death in Texas, you go through a lot of different steps, and every step has lawyers who are involved, and lawyers are criticizing what the lawyers did below them, and...
Larry, I just wanted to let you know that we heard from our reporter in Huntsville, and the witnesses are exiting the building, so the execution has taken place.
Okay, so I don't know if that came over the air, but the fact is the execution has taken place. Billy Jack Kretzinger has apparently been, his death sentence has apparently been executed by the state of Texas. We had very few executions. I think this is our fifth this year. Texas still leads the nation. I think we're five of 12 that have been done so far in the state of Texas. And today is September the 4th. It's my understanding that Texas still has 10 scheduled executions in this year, before the end of the year. And I don't think they're a whole lot done after the middle of December. So which means that in the next few months, some decisions have to be made. It's a complicated process. As the habeas lawyer on Mr. Kretzinger mentioned, what every lawyer on the appellate side is trying to do, on the post-conviction side is trying to do, is to get the defendant a fair hearing, a date in court. Can we go back and do anything to bring up all these things that we've learned now? And I can tell you that hindsight is 20/20. You know, trying a case one time, you might do a bang up job, but I have never seen a lawyer who's ever tried a case and looked back on it and says, I did everything exactly perfectly. There are some things, even when you have a victory, you look back and say, I could have done this better, I could have done that better, I could have done the other better. And so the explanation as to why it takes so long, justice just takes a long time. In the interim, in the intervening time, in the 10, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, the law also changes. As we saw in the series of Penry cases, where the law changed during the time that the sentence was being appealed. So it's a complicated process. It's no matter what we do, it's not a perfect process. I don't know if we're going to get Joseph Clark back. He just called in. So he's not going to come back. He just reported to us that the execution had been completed.
Yes, and I'd like to bring it back to Billy Jack Kretzinger, because this is another needless execution. It is the Texas has carried out a penalty to no effect whatsoever, not on the crime rate, not even on closure. Closure, I think, is an overworked and misused term. What people, instead of closure, people should be talking about sympathy for the victims. That is what's important. That is what the state should be affording, not revenge. And because revenge doesn't replace the loss. It doesn't heal. It leaves people just as empty as before.
And what is the effect of this delay for 15, 17 years on the victims' families? Does that, and I do not know many victims' families, but does that keep the wound open for a whole lifetime? Is it sometimes better to put them in prison and be over with and they can go on their way? I don't know.
Well, that's a good question. We've mentioned a number of times already that the death penalty is reserved for a few cases. There's plenty of other murders that are really horrific that have victims that are traumatized, and there is no death penalty. There is life in prison. That's what happens in other states and in other countries as well, but that hasn't led to any difference, as far as we know, in the well-being of the victims. That there's just no evidence at all that the death penalty improves people's lives, even those who have suffered the loss of a loved one.
Your clients you represented, you have met and talked to most of these people in prison?
All my clients
in Ray Hill used to say when he was, it's his show, he used to say that the man they're executing is not the man that committed the crime. Do you find some truth in that after 15, 20 years in prison, that's not the same person who did these horrible crimes.
In my experience, my clients, to a man, and that's the only, I've only represented men because there's 99% of death row, have become reflective, intelligent human beings over the course of their incarceration.
And isn't
they were not that, I guarantee you, when they went in.
But wasn't that the theory of the penitentiary to be penance, where you go and sit down and think about your sins and change? And I guess what I'm getting to is to execute somebody when they're doing bad is one thing, but giving him 10 or 15 years to think about what he did and change what he does and change his life, we're now executing somebody who might be a benefit to society. Does that make sense?
In my experience, that is unexceptionally true. Apart from, I have represented numerous clients, all of whom changed significantly during the course of their incarceration. The ones that haven't were mentally ill when they went in. Those that are there, at least the ones that have been my clients, have not only thought about their own cases, they've thought about other their fellow prisoners' situation. They've tried to help each other out. They are far different from the person that was
the question becomes is
the clinic.
Shouldn't the death decision be made closer to the execution than the time of the crime? Shouldn't we judge that person on who he is today rather than who he was 15 years ago? Isn't that only fair to him and also give an incentive to people to see it works, to change?
I think that's an absolutely valid point. The one response is that that's what clemency is for. But clemency is a political process. It's not a judicial process. And I believe that, yes, that judicial proceedings in which the penological justification, to use fancy terms, is reviewed again by the courts would be a welcome and intelligent and far more civilized way to proceed if you're going to proceed with what I consider to be a punishment that should not exist.
And as far as the victims are concerned, and I don't know about this, but if my family member was a victim of a horrible crime, having the person who committed that crime executed, okay, it's over. But if he's in jail the rest of his life, and I can go down and see him, maybe I can come to peace with what he did to my father. Maybe I can come to peace with what he did by getting another man that did it. Does that help close you?
Well, I think for some people that has actually happened. They have gotten to know the person that killed their loved ones, and then they have realized that it will not help their situation to have to continue punishing
but
them.
We're not talking about revenge now. We're talking about
that's
forgiveness.
Right. But it is understandable that people would be so angry, so hurt, that they would want revenge. We're actually taught that revenge is, actually a virtue in this culture. It's part of the fabric of our daily existence. And look at any sort of entertainment, and that is a major theme, is revenge. And people, I think, do place some value on that. I think it's an empty virtue. I think it's misguided. That is my belief about the matter. But others, I do have a different perspective on it.
It's been educational today. It's been joy talking to you, sir.
It's about 6:55, 6:54 and change. We have been witness, all of us, to the fact that the state of Texas has apparently carried out the execution of the death sentence handed down by a jury in Fort Worth on Billy Jack Crutzinger, for the murder, the capital murder of two elderly ladies in Fort Worth, Texas, back in 2003. We are here because of what the state has done. We normally, Arab Voices is heard at this time, and normally Marlo Blue is your host. I had to fill in today, Larry. I'm normally just one of the legal commenters. For the next several, between now and the end of the year, Texas has as many as 10 executions scheduled. We hope they don't do that many. But if they do, if they are there, then we will be here. This is Larry Douglas along with Mike Gillespie and James Riddick signing off. This has been Execution Watch for Billy Jack Kretzinger. Good evening.
They're killing me.